Everybody, it's dark now, pretty early. Thank you for being here. Sorry I was late. First thing, I want to thank the 9 or 10 or 11 teachers who participated in the final Gandavyuha session last Wednesday. And thanks especially to Jean, who organized it and had the very good idea that a multitude of voices would be the most fitting way to finish the sutra. And so I was able to listen to it all, and I really enjoyed it. The great variety of things that came out and all the different approaches, everything from a poem of exaltation to the idea of adornments, to the practice of mudita, sympathetic joy, to some sound advice about making sure you eat the right food and get a good night's sleep, to an art show in New York City that I happen to have seen myself a long time ago, or not so long ago, I guess within the last year or so, which was a good show that was quite germane, it turned out. To a wonderful guided meditation at the end that I'm sure convinced every one of you that you are in reality already in your heart a limitless bodhisattva. So all of that was quite something and very beautiful. And as I said at the beginning of our Gandavyuha study, I was a little tentative, you know, about how this was going to go. We did it about 10 or 15 years ago, and I think it sort of left a lot of people in the dust. They wasn't their favorite, so I wasn't sure how this was going to go. So I was really happy that it seemed to go much better this time, and a lot of you somehow found a way to get into it, your own way to get into the sutra. And as we said a million times in talking about it, that the sutra is so cosmic and so vast, it is all but overwhelming. And what a contrast this is with the early Buddhist teachings of the Pali Canon and maybe the Zen teachings too, which are much simpler and plainer and more down to earth. So, but at the all-day sit this last Saturday, we were chanting the Metta Sutta, which of course is a very early Pali text. And I noticed the lines in the Metta Sutta, "May I suffuse love over the entire world, above, below, and all around without limit, cultivating an infinite goodwill toward the whole world." The Metta Sutta says that. So it uses words like without limit, infinite, in all directions, above, below, and all around, in all directions. While the Avatamsaka Sutra, and I think Roberta pointed this out in what she said last Wednesday, it actually simply is fleshing out and dramatizing and demonstrating the words limitless and infinite and all around, in all directions. So I guess this goes to show you that the common sense Buddhist teachings and the cosmic Buddhist teachings are really the same from the very, very beginning. And as Dogen certainly believed, there's nothing in Zen or in Mahayana Buddhism that isn't already there in one form or another in the very earliest teachings. Mahayana Buddhism just emphasizes some things like compassion, brings those things out that are already there to the absolute maximum. And so I say that because now it's a kind of a bridge to the text we're going to be considering now, the Dhammapada, which is really different in style and presentation. It's simple, it's short relative to the Avatamsaka Sutra. And I hope that we will savor it and read it closely over a period of several months. I'm not sure how long, but I was imagining that maybe we could read it for several months, through November, through December, even January and February, and take our time with it. If we read it that long, that would be 14 weeks, because in November and December we take a little time off. We don't meet the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, which is in a couple of weeks. We don't meet Christmas Eve, of course, or New Year's Eve, or around that time. We take a couple of weeks off. So if we started now and went to the end of this end of February, it would be 14 weeks. And there are 26 short chapters of the text, so that might be a good amount of time to really savor this text. Anyway, that's what I'm thinking now, and we'll see how that goes. Tonight I want to introduce the text and look at the first chapter or two. And I'm going to be traveling for 3 weeks within the next month or so, 6 weeks or so. So I won't be here next week. I won't be here November 3rd or 10th when I'll be down in Mexico during our annual retreat down there. So Sue, James, and Christopher are going to be speaking on the text in those 3 weeks. Okay, so then I went to my shelf to find the Dhammapada, and I found that I had 6 translations of the Dhammapada, which sounds like a lot, but actually it's not very many. There are more than 50 English translations of the Dhammapada. And the Dhammapada is a really, really old text. Probably it's the aphorisms, maybe somebody has done this, hunted down, you know, where all these aphorisms are in the earliest Pali suttas, because I think that's where they come from. I think they're originally lifted from other suttas, a little bit like a koan collection, right, where stories are lifted from other places and gathered together in one bundle. In a way, that's what the Dhammapada is, I think. And it's a kind of a Dharma primer. And it's also meant to inspire us and spur us on to practice. In a way, it's just like the Gandavyuha does. It was first translated into Western languages, and I actually think that Max Müller translated it maybe into German before it appeared in English. But it was already in Western languages by the second half of the 19th century. That was the moment when Western people were beginning to be really impressed and astonished to learn about this religion of the mysterious East called Buddhism that seemed to be quite reasonable and psychologically oriented. That the religion, they thought, seemed to be about self-transformation and self-transcendence, and had almost nothing to do with worship of a supreme being. In fact, Buddhism didn't even seem to have the idea of a supreme creator God, which in the West, it was always taken to be axiomatic that that was the sort of bottom line of religion. God created the world. That's every, you know, religions might have different ideas about who that God was and what God that God wanted from you, but basically, that was what religion was, right? And Buddhism never had that thought. So this was quite astonishing to people. I often tell the story that when they had the first World Parliament of Religions in 1893, they didn't know whether they should invite the Buddhists, because they didn't know whether Buddhism counted as a religion. If it didn't have a god, was it a religion? So this was very surprising to Western people in the 19th century. And they were impressed with it, and they were impressed with Buddhism, and they were impressed with the Dhammapada as a very poetic and beautiful and straightforward exposition of what Buddhism was all about. And as I say, it's a poetic and inspirational text. It's a text that maybe like the Psalms or Ecclesiastes or some of the verses of the Dhammapada, of the Tao Te Ching, you could memorize and recite by heart for your own edification and your own religious formation. So the historical Buddha, as you know, we all know this, he practiced continuously and constantly. He didn't take any days off. There was no idea of the Sabbath, you know, in the Buddha's way of thinking, so there were no days off. And the Buddha quite organically established a monastic community that eventually, during his own lifetime, became quite extensive. But by the time his life had been going for quite a while, the community was so large he was never with the entire community. It was sort of separated here and there, groups here and groups there. And the Buddha was always living with a subgroup of monastics, but not in one place. Usually they were traveling around, wandering from place to place. Sometimes they would stay for a short time, sometimes a longer time. Typically he would camp outside of a city or a village, and he would hold Dharma meetings, and he would give teachings, and everybody was invited. Anyone was invited. So in other words, he wasn't just living in monastic enclaves with special people. He was always open to all kinds of people. And so he was teaching monastics, and he was certainly quite concerned about those people who had made a commitment to do nothing but practice. But he was also happy and thrilled to teach kings and noble people and rulers and ordinary people, any kind of people, all kinds of people. And if you read the Pali Canon, you find all kinds of circumstances in which the Buddha encountered all kinds of people. And this is an important point that Thanissaro Bhikkhu mentions in his really good introduction to the Dhammapada that I'm going to quote from in a minute. And the reason that I bring this up is because this is us, right? We are all kinds of people. Some of us are sort of quasi-monastics, maybe we priests, you know, who wear the okesa, others not. And we have all kinds of relationships to the Dharma in terms of the level of how much we feel committed to it or how central it is to our lives. So this is good to know that the Buddha was there for all those kinds of people. And we just read the Gandavyuha Sutra, in which complete and total awakening, complete and total commitment, which involves endless time and endless love and omniscience and saving all sentient beings. In the Gandavyuha Sutra, that's the only way. That's the only thing that's discussed. But certainly the Buddha taught that from the beginning, even if the earliest, at least the historically earliest expressions of it, were not as cosmic as the Gandavyuha, he taught that too. But he also taught very down-to-earth ways of simply improving your life, short of total cosmic awakening. Now, I'm pretty sure that the Buddha didn't like the monastics better than all the other people who came to him, or take them more seriously than all the other people who came to him, because the whole essence of the Buddhist practice, when you think about it, is equanimity. Literally, equal love and respect for all. Because all preferences would in the end inevitably lead to attachment and aversion, which is the root of suffering. So equanimity is not just something nice, it's sort of central to the whole path. So that's why I'm pretty sure that he wouldn't have favored this group over that group. And when you read the sutras, it's pretty clear that he's approaching absolutely everyone with an equanimous eye. Now, of course, the Buddha understood that people are very different one from another, and their commitments and their paths in this lifetime are quite different. Some have this, you know, monastic or vowing commitment, others not, or at least not yet. But he saw all of them, I'm pretty sure, with equally loving eyes. And remember, the Buddha started out with suffering. That's what spurred the Buddha on. That's why the Buddha undertook his practice, because of suffering. He was really concerned about suffering. And he was concerned about the suffering of every person. And whatever any person could get from Dharma practice that would decrease their suffering, the Buddha wanted to give that teaching to that person, to help that person decrease their suffering. And so you could say that the Buddha had Plan A and Plan B. Plan A was full bodhisattva awakening, which in the language of the early sutras was called nirvana, release, total release from the cycle of birth and death. That was Plan A. Plan B was a better rebirth, so that nirvana could eventually be achieved in a more advantageous subsequent lifetime. Since the Buddha also taught, and this is very clear, that rebirth is a phenomenon that is very real and takes place every moment, for us, rebirth just means a better tomorrow, a better next year, a better lifetime. So whether or not we give up every other concern and the only thing we care about is awakening, our applying ourselves to practice with as much diligence as possible will definitely make our lives better. More peaceful, wiser, more stable, more loving, as I suppose most of you listening to me right now can attest. I have no doubt that that is true. We do not have to be elite, extremely meditating monastics in order to be true and full disciples of the Buddha and to carry out the Buddha's teachings. If you read the Gandavyuha, you might think that you do have to be completely a fanatic to do this. But that's not what you're going to feel when you read the Dhammapada, in which the Buddha often gives just good, sound, practical advice for reducing stress and having a happier and more peaceful life. So as everybody knows, I'm constantly obsessed with the question of language. I can't get over it. Maybe one of these days, but so far not. And Sue, when she shared her feelings for the Dhammapada, for the Gandavyuha last time, she mentioned that she also, another writer, you know, is also concerned about language, and that's why she said she was so attracted to Zen, because especially Dogen Zen has a lot to do with language. Zen has lots of teachings about language, much more than other forms of Buddhism, and that's because Zen understands that language is fundamental to human consciousness. Maybe that is what characterizes human consciousness per se, is language. And that is has always been my attraction to poetry, which is the boiler room of language, you know, the basement, down there where they stoke the fires. I think of it that way because actually when I was a kid we had a basement with a boiler downstairs. You had to put coal on it, and that was my job, to shovel coal onto the boiler. So I guess it was one step from there to poetry, because poetry is the boiler room, you know, of language, where they stoke the fire so the people in the upper floors can be warm and comfortable and talk to one another as if they knew what they were saying. So I was very interested to read Thanissara's introduction to his translation, which is very good, his introduction. And we're using, as you know, Thanissaro's translation, which is easily available. The entire thing, including all the introductory material that I'm going to quote from, is all available freely online. Thanissaro has written many, 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 many books that are all good, and he's very smart. And he's one of the Buddhist teachers that I admire, contemporary Buddhist teachers that I admire the most. He is really an extraordinary Buddhist teacher. But he's never published his books other than to give them away. So his books are all free. There's never, you can't pay any money for a Thanissaro book. So we're using his translation as well as Gil Fronsdale's really good translation. The Thanissaro's introduction is the only introduction, and I've read a bunch of different introductions, right, by all the six translations that I have, each one has an introduction. Thanissaro is the only one that goes into detail about the poetic form of the text of the Dhammapada. And that's what I want to quote for you, because it's kind of interesting, at least to me it is. He begins by introducing the term kavya, which is the Pali verse form in which the Dhammapada is written. He says that it's only quite recently that any scholars have paid any attention to the fact that the Dhammapada is not only a spiritual classic, it's also a literary classic. It's one of the best examples of this poetic form. This, by the way, is also true of Dogen, who is Dogen was the, more or less, I think this is right, he was the inventor of prose in Japanese, because before that, just like in the West, everybody wrote in Latin, in Japanese. In Japan, everybody wrote in Chinese, and Dogen wrote the Shobogenzo in Japanese, thereby inventing Japanese prose. And his poetry is an early examples of, some of the best style in Japanese poetry. So Dogen also, there was like a seamless concatenation between his religious teachings and his effects on literature, and that's true also for the Dhammapada. The purpose of the kavya form was to give instructions in the higher things of life. Poetry was kavya was particularly suited to that. And to do that specifically in a delightful way with language, so that you would be attracted to these teachings and you would be able to remember them and want to take them into your heart because the language of them was so attractive and so persuasive. Not argumentation, but the beauty of the language, startling and peaceful and beautiful. So I'm going to read some passages from Thanissaro's introduction. To make the wise path attractive, the techniques of the poetry are used to give savor, and the word savor, rasa in Pali, to the message. So that's why you wrote it in poetry, because you wanted to give savor to the message. It wasn't going to be enough to just say the stuff. You had to say it in such a way that it had a flavor. Ancient Indian aesthetic treatises devoted a great deal of discussion to the notion of savor and how it could be conveyed. The basic theory was this: artistic composition expressed states of emotion or states of mind called bhava. And interestingly, in Buddhism, bhava it means cultivation. Also, it often means meditation. Sometimes bhava is used to describe meditation. But here, it's states of mind gained from encountering artistic objects in words. The basic emotions that would be produced by these kavya poems was love, delight, humor, grief, anger, energy, fear, disgust, and astonishment. The reader or listener exposed to these presentations of emotions, and this I find this really interesting, did not participate in those emotions directly. Rather, the person savored them as an aesthetic experience at one remove from the emotion. So when you're reading about grief, you feel something, But it's not grief that you feel. You feel compassion. It's a different emotion at one remove. It's true, right? When you think about it, when you experience a work of art that is meant to convey feelings of anger or beauty or frustration or love, you do feel it, but you feel it differently, for sure, right, than if it was actually happening to you. So it's interesting, they have a whole theory of the difference between emotions experienced through reading sutras or poems and emotions in the raw. The savor of energy is not energy itself, but admiration for heroism. The savor of love is not love, but an experience of sensitivity. The savor of astonishment is a sense of the marvelous. The proof of the indirectness of the aesthetic experience was that some of the basic emotions were decidedly unpleasant, while the savor of the emotions in reading about them was to be enjoyed, which is true, right? You go to nobody wants to be murdered, you know, but you watch a TV show about murder and you don't feel like somebody just murdered you. I hope not, anyway. You feel something, though. You're not inured to the feeling. So it's kind of, anyway, I find that interesting. So he also says that among all these different emotions that an artistic work can present, usually the convention was that there was one of the emotions that was the most important. And so it was a convention to tell before the work what emotion was the most important one, and then to say that that is the supreme of all emotions. The Dhammapada, in verse 354, he says, states explicitly that the savor of the Dharma is the highest savor, which indicates that this is the basic savor of the work. So this is really an interesting thing, right? That there is a feeling of, I don't know what you would call it, there is a feeling of joy or happiness, right, in feeling the Dharma, in hearing the Dharma, in the truth of it. It's really a delightful thing, right? I mean, when you're hearing somebody talk about the Dharma, it's not the same thing as your own Dharma practice, but hearing the Dharma spoken, if in a beautiful and effective way, does create a feeling in us that certainly is positive and important, because it spurs us on to keep going with the Dharma. So anyway, it's kind of interesting. In a way, it's quite obvious, of course, but it's interesting that the Indian people that far back had a whole theory and practice of this. Let's see. I'll skip some of this, but a couple of other things that are not related to that subject, but I wanted to just pull out from this introduction. The factors needed to attain one's first taste of the goal of the Buddhist path are four. And this is Thanissara is saying this. First, associating with people of integrity, meaning good teachers with experience. Second, listening to their teachings. Third, using appropriate attention to inquire into the way those teachings apply to one's life. And fourth, practicing in line with the teachings in a way that does them justice. So that's sort of like very simple-minded, but it's quite true, isn't it? Find someone that you can trust, who seems to know what they're talking about and live it. Listen to what they say, but don't just do that. Check it out for yourself, investigate it, try to understand it, and then put it into practice. And that's the way that you transform your life. That's the earliest, in the Pali Canon, the Buddha says this. The other last piece of the introduction from Thanissara that I want to quote is, two emotions that play an important role and are kind of assumed in the text of the Dhammapada as sort of governing emotions. And one thing about the Dhammapada I was thinking is that it's amazingly straightforward and quite clear and absolutely unambiguous. Probably more so than our lives are. You know? I mean, we might think that things are a little murky, but the Dhammapada sees no murk. It's very, very clear. And the clarity is based on these two emotions. The first one is called samvega. Samvega is a strong sense of dismay that comes with the realization that life is absolutely futile and meaningless in the way that it's ordinarily lived. And this emotion produces a sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of this meaningless cycle. And that's exactly what spurred the Buddha on, right? The Buddha was like freaked out at this. I mean, when you think about it, it is an outrageous thing, you know. We are given life so that we're going to lose it. You know, that's like outrageous. Who made this plan? You are born so that you can die. And you will definitely die. Terrible, terrible plan. It doesn't make sense. It's confusing. If you thought about it, you couldn't stand to live a day. So we all forget about it. That's how we get along. We get along, denial and forgetting about life, what life is the way that we all live. And as we know, denial is ultimately not that successful. So people are going around in a kind of crazy state. And so seeing that and having that emotion, you know, wow, this is an impossible situation. I got to do something. That's the one emotion that we need. The second emotion is called pasada, the clarity and serenity that come when one recognizes a teaching that presents the truth of the dilemma of existence and points the way out. You're happy when you think, ah, here's something that addresses this impossible situation. So that's an emotion, right? You feel, and I think the Dharma does really, I mean, you do, the Dharma, if you didn't already have dismay about the human condition, but maybe had a nagging sense that maybe it was dismal, the Dharma will bring that out in you, right? It'll bring out your dismay. And also, while it's doing that, it will give you the happiness to know that there's an answer to it. Most people, I think, this is very true for me, I thought that my problems were my fault, you know? Most people do, right? Everybody is happy and fine, except me. And I would be happy and I would be fine if I was a little more together and I had the right relationship or a better job or more money than I have now, or I was younger or something. No, it's not your fault. That's the human condition, and there's a way to address it. So those two emotions, samvega and pasada, I thought were worth sharing with you and mentioning. Okay, so now I get to the text itself, and I'm going to, for tonight anyway, I'm reading Dhanasaro's translation, and he translates the name of the first chapter. Other translators say dichotomies or other things. He translates it as simply at the pairs, P-A-I-R-S. And it's a contrast. It's on the one hand and that on the other hand. This on the one hand and that on the other hand. And these two words that I just discussed are the one hand and the other hand. On the one hand, samvega. Everything goes upside down. On the other hand, pasada. Everything is clarified. Everything is serene. So that's the pairs. So here the Buddha in these verses is setting up a to make it clear what he's talking about, what the Dharma is. He's setting up this contrast. If you want to know what the Dharma is, it's important to look at what's the opposite of the Dharma. And so those are the pairs. So here's Thanissara's words. Phenomena are... And he talks about how he's trying to make his translation imitate the poetic form of the kavya. So I don't know if you can see this, but in the book he uses lineation, uses different ways of organizing the lines on the page to try to do that. Most of the other translators translate in regular verse forms, which the original is in regular verse forms, but Thanissara uses the lineation as a way of poeticizing the text. Phenomena are, and I'll try in my reading of it to indicate how he sets his lines. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a corrupted heart, then suffering follows you as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you like a shadow that never leaves. So these are this is the first of the pairs. You can see the pair. One side is not paying attention to life, and the other side is paying attention. One is the non-path, and the other is the path. Phenomena, the word, I think the word is dhamma, dharma, the word that he translates as phenomena. And you could translate dharma as phenomena, and Gill translates it as experience, because there are no phenomena outside of experience. Phenomena in Buddhism means the things that we experience. So everything that in our life, he says, is preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. In other translations, use mind instead of heart. And as we all know, in Asian traditions, there is no distinction between the mind and the heart. It's one thing. It's in our languages, we have to either say heart or mind. If we say mind, it sounds mental and intellectual. If we say heart, it sounds emotional. But the word includes both the intellect and the emotion, all manifestations of consciousness, human consciousness. So I think it's good that he says heart, because mind, the heart seems more like it to me. So he says preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart. In other words, we make the world with our mind. The world we live in is a mind-heart-created world. Our consciousness creates the world. So what are we going to do with that? If we have a mind that is full of grasping and clinging and nastiness, we will suffer. And the metaphor he uses here is very important. You know, it says something. A wagon, you know, and this would have been contemporary, right? You pull a wagon with an ox, and that's a bit rough, right? The ox is pulling and hauling, the wagon is heavy, the wagon has a lot of friction against the dirt, against the hard dirt. It's a tough slog. And the wagon also makes tracks, right? It's going to make ruts. So the next wagon coming along is going to go on those same ruts. And you, when you come back the next day, you're going to go on those same ruts again and again and again, making those ruts deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. So that's the suffering, is like that. Whereas the happiness that will follow you, like a shadow, not like a cart with making ruts and pulling and hauling, a shadow isn't anything, right? It's like it's a form of created by light, and it's effortless. It just goes where you go. You know, you don't have to like produce your shadow, the way you have to whip the ox to make the cart keep going, the shadow just is there, easily and automatically and beautifully, wherever you are. So the metaphors do a lot of, give a lot of meaning to the text. And so this first verse is basically the foundation of the whole of the Dhammapada. This being so, don't you think that it would be better for you to pay attention to your mind then, to your heart, rather than not? Because if you don't, it's going to be painful, as maybe many of us have experienced in our lives. Whereas if we do pay attention, if we do watch the heart and try to awaken the heart and make the heart beautiful, calm and bright, as he says, we will have happiness. So that's the first and most basic dichotomy. And now we have some instances of how that works. He insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. And that's a quotation, that's somebody talking. He insulted me, bit me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. For those who brood on this, hostility is not stilled. In other words, he beat me, he robbed me, he hit me, but that's over. He went away. He took my money and he went away. But now I'm brooding on this. I'm saying to myself, he hit me, he insulted me, he beat me, he robbed me. The hostility is still there. Even though the guy who did it to me is gone, I'm now creating ongoingly this hostility. He insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. For those who don't brood on this, hostility is stilled. So that's a practice instruction, right? Something happens. It's very natural that we'll have lots of thoughts about it, and we'll go on and on and on and on and on with those thoughts. But now we know that that means we now are taking the original hostility and we're increasing it and making ourselves pretty miserable. You know, you can be obsessed by this, right? Somebody did something to you, it could ruin your entire life if you let it, even though it happened and now it's not happening anymore. But you keep it happening. So that tells you, find a way to understand that about your life and don't go on and on. In fact, Gill translates, instead of brood, he says, don't carry on. Carrying on that way increases the hostility. Don't carry on that way and hostility is stilled. Hostility is instilled through hostility, regardless. Hostility is stilled through non-hostility. This an unending truth. So I often give the example of a fire, you know. If somebody does something to you or something happens to you, a fire has been lit. And it might burn, and it might hurt. You can be patient and let the fire burn down, or you can keep adding fuel to it and make it into a conflagration. The fire could go on endlessly if you keep on adding fuel to it. So here the instruction is, don't add fuel. You know what that looks like. Don't do it. Do what it takes to not add fuel to the fire. So when there's hostility, practice non-hostility. Let the fires of hostility burn out. Don't add fuel to them. Unlike those who don't realize that we're here on the verge of perishing, those who do, their quarrels are stilled. Unlike those who don't realize that we're here on the verge of perishing, those who do, their quarrels are stilled. And this is really true, you know. there would never be a quarrel if you realized that you are going to die. You don't know when, possibly soon, and so is the person you're mad at. And if you really looked at yourself and looked at that other person and saw that very clearly, what are you quarreling about? You know, how trivial is it? So that's why recognition of impermanence, recognition of the truth of impermanence, that nothing can we hold on to, and life is fleeting all the time for you and everyone else. Here we are, a bunch of sad, poor people, exactly alike in any way that's important, on a tiny little ball spinning in the middle of God knows how much space. And what? We're arguing with one another over who got more stuff. It seems absurd when you think about it. And yet, this is exactly what we do. And we can be very miserable, right? We can make this a very miserable situation. But if we really, and I love the way he puts it, we're on the verge of perishing. Because that's what time is, right? Time is being on the verge, always, of perishing. It's like time is like a cliff. We're sitting on the edge of a cliff. We're about to fall off the cliff. Every moment we're sitting on the edge of that cliff, on the verge of perishing. If you know that, who are you going to be mad at? Why would you ever be mad at anybody? That's what bodhisattva compassion, that's why impermanence equals emptiness equals compassion. Because we're all sitting on the verge. We have nothing to hold on to. Of course we love each other, because we're all in the same boat. And we all understand each other perfectly. I mean, that's the truth. Even though that's not how we live it, not how we see it. One who stays focused on the beautiful is unrestrained. So that sounds good, right? Focused on the beautiful, don't you like that? But he means it in the opposite way. One who stays focused on the beautiful is unrestrained with the senses, knowing no moderation in food, apathetic, unenergetic. All those things go together for him. Mara overcomes him as a wind, a weak tree. One who stays focused on the foul is restrained with regard to the senses, knowing moderation in food, full of conviction and energy. Mara does not overcome this person as the wind, a mountain of rock. So this is a feature of early Buddhism that I think we don't appreciate much. I think we have our own traditions in the West about teaching us about moderation. You know, it's obvious that being immoderate to excess is going to be bad for your health and everything else. So we understand that. But the Buddhists, from the earliest times, and I'm going to sneeze, excuse me, in advance. Oh, maybe I moved the microphone. Excuse me. Somehow it seemed the most sensible way for the Buddhists to overcome what must have been, I don't know, maybe people were different, you know, in those days. I noticed this in reading the Talmud also, that it seemed like people's passions were all but overwhelming, really unruly. I think the average person now has better control. Maybe this is true. The average person today, for some reason, maybe has better control over their passions than they did thousands of years ago. Because the Buddhists really felt like strong measures were needed. So the best way, if you're attracted to, let's say, sexually, to the member of the opposite sex or whatever sex, you have, you know, you see them as beautiful, desirable. The best thing to do is to meditate on their intestines and their rectum and their and the poop inside of them that they just ate lunch yesterday, and notice how their lunch is going down their esophagus and into their stomach, and what's going on in their stomach and how it goes out. Literally, you know, notice that. The human body is a foul heap of, you know, bacteria and little creatures, and it's stinky, and, you know, it's really not an attractive... How could the human body be an attractive thing? It just really is. I mean, like, look inside somebody's nostrils, you know, closely. And you're not thinking, oh, this is so beautiful. No, it's a, you know... Or go to the medical school where they dissect the cadavers and open up the... You're not impressed with... You're not having... I mean, unless you're really weird, you're not having, like, big sexual feelings, right? So that's what the Buddhists... They had a very almost a program of meditating on the foul. Not because things were foul... that was more true than they're beautiful. No, I think it's any more true that the object of your desire is foul and not beautiful. No, the object of your desire is from one point of view very foul and icky, and from another point of view very beautiful. Both of those things are true. But since you're naturally going to be caught up by the beautiful part, better bring up the foul part as a balance so that you don't get caught. That was the theory. And so there's a lot of stuff in Buddhism about how foul and how objectionable it is to be alive. You know, you almost get the idea that the Buddhists would... And you know, the Buddhists might have concluded that the thing to do was jump off a cliff and get out of this immediately, but they realized that wouldn't work because you'd only be reborn into a much worse situation. So that was no answer. Anyway, that's why they say focused on the foul. Be focused on the foul. Be restrained with regard to the senses, knowing moderation in food, full of conviction and energy. So I think in our practice, we actually don't do that ancient practice. We don't focus, although I would recommend it, you know. There are times when it would be useful. But basically, we do, though, I think, recognize the importance of taking care of ourselves. That means everything, with moderation and care and concern for the body and the mind, right? Not too much trashy stuff for the mind, not too much trashy stuff for the body, exercise and so on and so on. So we can be strong and stable like a rock, or we can be knocked over like a tree in the wind, depending on how we handle ourselves every day with our daily habits. He who, depraved, devoid of truthfulness and self-control, puts on the ochre robe, doesn't deserve the ochre robe, the robe of the Buddha, the robe of the Sangha. But he or she who is free of depravity, endowed with truthfulness and self-control, well established in the precepts, truly deserves the ochre robe. So the word depravity is a very strong word, which usually seems to us like an extreme word. I don't think it's meant here in extreme sense. It just means if you don't take care of your behavior and your senses, you don't stick to being true and real with your life, you're a sloppy, lazy, selfish person. Don't wear the robe. You make the robe. You disrespect the robe. The robe is only to be worn by someone who is free of depravity and is endowed with truthfulness and self-control and well established in the precepts. So that's what the robe stands for. That's what the robe means. That's what the robe actually is, in fact. So you could say somebody wearing the robe who is depraved and all these other things, they're not really wearing the robe. Somebody who's not wearing the robe and takes care of all of these things is actually wearing the robe, even though they appear not to be, because that's what the robe actually is. Those who regard non-essence as essence, see essence as non-essence, don't get to the essence, ranging about in wrong resolves. And here the essence means the Dharma, the way to live. But those who know essence as essence and non-essence as non-essence get to the essence, ranging about in right resolves. Don't waste your time with non-essentials. The only thing important is how we live. Pay attention to that. As rain seeps into an ill-thatched hut, so passion, the undeveloped mind. As rain doesn't seep into a well-thatched hut, so passion does not, the well-developed mind. So here again, the metaphor does a lot of work. Practice is a kind of a craft, right? It's all day long, every day, taking care of our mind and our heart and our body. And that's what it is to thatch a roof. You know, it's a very painstaking work to thatch a roof. And if you do it sloppily, the roof leaks. Whereas if you do it very carefully and painstakingly, it doesn't. Also, leaking is a kind of old word in Buddhism, meaning holding to the passions in such a way that your life energy leaks out. Here he grieves hereafter. In both worlds, the wrongdoer grieves. He grieves, he's afflicted, seeing the corruption of his deeds. Here she rejoices hereafter. In both worlds, the merit maker rejoices. She rejoices, is jubilant, seeing the purity of her deeds. So there's actually, in fact, nothing more satisfying than knowing one is doing one's best to live a good life, and nothing more nerve-wracking and anxious-making than knowing that one is not. Even a really good crook has a guilty conscience, or so the Buddha claims. Somewhere in there, you know, there's a conscience. Somewhere in there. That's what the Buddha says. Here, they're tormented hereafter. In both worlds, the wrongdoer is tormented. Tormented at the thought, I've done wrong. Having gone to a bad destination, tormented all the more. Meaning, bad things have happened to that person. Next life, very bad life. Or they go to jail, or everybody abandons them, or something. Here, they delight hereafter. And here means in this life, and hereafter means in a subsequent life or in the next year. In both worlds, the merit maker delights. They delight at the thought, I've made merit. Having gone to a good destination, they delight all the more. If a person recites many teachings, but is heedless and doesn't do what the teachings say, then it's like being a cowherd counting the cattle of others. That person has no share in the contemplative life. If, on the other hand, the person recites next to nothing, but actually follows the Dharma, lives in accord with the Dharma, abandoning passion, aversion, delusion, alert, their mind well released, not clinging either here or hereafter, that person has their share in the contemplative life. So this is really setting up these pairs to tell us that we have a choice. You know, it's really, we're all, Buddha is asserting, you know, that this is actually the way it is for everybody. This is the way it is. And it's up to you. It's up to everybody. Everybody has this choice. And everybody has these two paths. You can go this way or that way. There's no other way, he's saying. And you can do it, you know, more or less thoroughly, but you choose what kind of a person to be in this lifetime. And then the Buddha is going to, throughout the Dhammapada, give some suggestions and instructions for how to follow the path and how to receive the happiness and the joy of living a life that takes into account death and impermanence and difficulty and yet is a life of happiness, joy, and ease. So that's the first chapter, and we have 25 more chapters to go and lots of time to cover. Then we can always go fast if we get tired and want to do it faster, but let's see. How about we get into groups of three and discuss this question of the pairs? How does it strike you? Now, as I say, it's very clear and very unambiguous. Do you feel inspired by that? And do you think, yeah, that makes sense? Or do you feel like, no, the clarity and and the lack of ambiguity in that doesn't strike me as being real to my life? It's not that straightforward. So that's, anyway, you see what I'm getting at. How does this Dhammapada format strike you? Does it seem something that's inspiring and makes you want to practice and you believe it? Or does it seem like it's somehow, I don't know, naive or too clear-cut? So let's get into groups of three, and everybody take 3 minutes each person. 3, 3, 3. Another 3, 12 minutes. You come back, and we'll see what happened. Thank you all very much for listening to that. I really appreciate it. It's a wonderful text. You know, it's great to read it, and we have at least 2 translations you can compare if you want, and it's interesting to look at the different translations, at least 1 or 2. Anyway, enjoy your conversations. I'll see you soon. Thank you.
Recording stopped.